Talk given, Saturday, 22nd March, 1975. Perhaps the most outstanding feature of all the religious teachings regarding the living of the holy life, regarding coming to fulfillment as man, given by all the great teachers of the past, is their emphasis upon the practice of the moralities. Every single teacher emphasized that. None of the perfected holy ones delved into metaphysics or propound systems of philosophy. Although, as a consequence of their teaching, many great systems of philosophy have arisen. But they themselves concentrated upon emphasizing living first the life which was pure in heart, meaning the moral life. Side by side with that, the life which was pure in mind, that is, freeing the mind of all bias and prejudice, of all preconceptions and assumptions, and freeing the mind of the accumulated residue of past impressions, painful or pleasant, which form the stuff which we call the unconscious in us. So they were concerned first and foremost with this purification process. And the word morality, where religion is concerned, must not be thought of in a sense similar to morality in the ordinary social and certainly in the conventional sense which we think of in the world of affairs. Business morality, political morality, and all the rest of it. They were concerned with morality in the sense of transcendent ethic, meaning thereby not merely an ethic which was based upon the principle of reciprocity, but which was absolute. Because where anything is based upon reciprocity, there is always a separation between two at least. Otherwise, the phenomenon of reciprocity cannot possibly take place. But if there is a separation anywhere at all, then one is constantly subject to the conditions for conflict. The conditions which make for the expression of self, granting that the circumstances were provocative enough, at the expense of he whom we call the other person. But the teachings of the Holy Ones were concerned with transcending this tragic separation of self and not self. You and I. And of releasing into human consciousness, into the consciousness of every single individual, the absolute fact of the unity of life, of existence. They knew, not merely intellectually, not merely philosophically, but as an actual fact, that we live in a universe, not a multiverse. And therefore, any separation in mind and consciousness between oneself and anything else means the contradiction of the truth of our being. So they were concerned with a transcendental ethic. The great values which we have, which we call great values, even in the ethic of reciprocity, and which we believe is living the good life, those same values are transcendentalized to such an extent that there is no question anymore of myself living in terms of those values, provided you also do likewise. Now you'll see the tremendous implications of this. Is not the breakdown of all human relationships everywhere in the world, on the personal scale, the national scale, the international scale, is not the breakdown of relationships simply due to the fact that a person acknowledges that he will do good and be loving and kind and true to another, provided the other is the same to him. And that if he goes beyond a certain limit, then there will be conflict, misery, destruction, evil, everything. Now you see, the great ones knew what was the truth. That is why they never bothered themselves at a worldly level with worldly problems. Because they knew that all worldly problems stem from within the individual himself, the conflict and the discord within himself. But if he lives by a transcendental ethic, the resolution of all discords comes from a transcendental depth, and that is the only thing that can heal, that can make whole, complete, and perfect. Any problem tackled at its own level, whatever that level may be, can never be solved. There will always be the seeds of further conflict at its own level. Hence, this extraordinary emphasis upon the transcendent, whatever the transcendent be. Call it God, call it Brahman, or Atma, or Allah, or Ramazda, or the Absolute, or the Supreme Energy, or whatever you like, whatever phrase you like. But it is that transcendent which is the ultimate root, the ultimate reality and the ultimate truth of our being, from which everything, all power emerges, which can bring to true fruition. Otherwise, it is doomed to failure. Now, that is one aspect, the ethical aspect. The other aspect deals with this aspect of our human nature and being, which is special to us, the mind. This is not to suggest for a moment that animals have no soul, so to say, no psyche. They have feelings. They even have some sort of ideas. They even have the capacity to be or to act as if they were tool makers, like man is. The intelligence of animals has been considerably underrated. But in modern times, we are discovering more and more how very intelligent in their own way they are. They don't do algebra, it is true, or electronics or something like that. But they have their electronic system at work naturally. And as far as that goes, it is, shall we put it, say, not exactly inefficient. And in many instances, it is more efficient than ours. Now, this thing, the mind, with regard to man, has this extraordinary capacity of looking into oneself and awakening to the fact of our own withinness in a manner which in all probability no animal, no plant or stone or anything has. We can do it in a manner and to an extent which puts us in a sphere completely different from the whole of the animal world and the plant world. Now, this has to come to fruition. What is its fruition? And this is where the worldly educationists and teachers and everyone has gone wrong. They think it is the acquisition of knowledge. Knowledge is necessary from the worldly point of view for the sake of the know-how, but only that far and no further. But man labors under this terrible delusion that the more knowledge he has, the more evidence he has for this, that and the other, he will be able to do this, that and the other and achieve so and so and attain this or whatever it may be. You see how completely self-centered it is, this acquisition of knowledge. What has man done with new knowledge which he has acquired throughout the ages? First and foremost, he has immediately misused it. Every new discovery which lends, which brings control over nature, control over the forces and the powers of nature, whatever they may be, the first thing we do is to misuse that power. We have not begun to understand, and this is where wisdom comes in, that power is invariably and inevitably misused unless and until there is the harmony of love and wisdom come to fruition. Wisdom is associated with this intelligence which is our tremendous potentiality. The intelligence which can see the truth of things, of persons, of situations immediately. How? First and foremost, by being sensitive enough. Second, by being attentive enough. Now, obviously, attentiveness here is not like attending to a lecture or attending to classwork or attending to the meal you are cooking and so forth. It is a different kind of attentiveness. In all worldly situations, our attentiveness is self-oriented, self-centered, has a particular purpose, is restricted to that which is limited and particular, which is born, which proceeds, comes to an end, dies. It is confined to the realm of mortality. But this transcendent attentiveness is of a totally different nature. It is an attentiveness which is utterly devoid of all self-consciousness. Now, this attentiveness is the attentiveness without which intelligence, buddhi, the real meaning of the word buddhi, without which buddhi cannot function, this power to see the truth of things immediately. Because the truth of things is distorted by us as long as we are self-oriented and self-conscious. We relate it to ourselves instead of seeing the thing exactly as it is. And when we relate it to ourselves, all our conditioning, all our beliefs, our preconceptions, our ideas, our convictions, and all the rest of the rubbish comes into play, and distorts that which is conveyed to us through the senses. Now the Holy One saw this. So we have the great teachings regarding ethic, the transcendental ethic, and this discipline of the mind by which the mind is liberated into being attentive transcendentally, wherein there is not a trace of isolative self-consciousness. And in this, there comes fulfillment as man. If you like to use theistic language, the divine will with regard to the purpose of our existence and what we are here for and all the rest of it is fulfilled then. The Son of Man, which means the Son of Mind, remember, the word man and mind have only one root, has come to perfect fulfillment, to fruition, and therefore is identical with the Brahmaputra, the Son of God. Why identical? Because the word God, the word Brahma, or you can use any such word you like, you see, represents for human beings the ultimate realization possible to you or to me. That's just what the word God represents. But theologians and those with vested interests in the religious sphere and the tens of thousands of others out of sheer ignorance have fought shy of this. They have said this is arrogance, hubris, terrible arrogance, terrible conceit. This is the sin of Lucifer. It is not the sin of Lucifer. The sin of Lucifer was to aim at equality with the Almighty. There was the Almighty. I, Lucifer, am a separate one. That was the sin. But if I am totally unself-conscious, my whole being is given up to the one only absolute reality. And in that, there is no sin. The very source of sin is wiped out there. So the word God represents our supreme potentiality. You can use the Buddhistic phrase, the unborn, the unbecome, the unmade. You can use any such terms you like, which are more agreeable to your own intellectual and emotional nature. Doesn't matter what terms you use. But we have to see the truth of the matter. Now, this leads in its ultimate fruition to the state of communion. Through the years, you have heard me talk about communion. You have heard, you know this teaching yourselves. I've told you nothing new. It's the old truth. But have we even begun to understand the nature of this communion? First, let us recall one or two points which we considered when we last met here. The difficulty of living the religious life in this sort of sense, the difficulty of living the religious life in the milieu that the modern world affords us. There are those who make the mistake of trying to run away from the modern world in order to live the religious life. Now I call it a mistake for this reason. if I go away from the world in order to live the religious life, I have separated myself from the world. I have done the very thing that emphasizes my ego, that serves my will, not thine, O Lord. You see, this is the simple fact. Our day and age is such that the old idea of living the contemplative life in a monastery or an ashram or something is past. Something new has to come into this world, and it has to come in terms of what we are pleased to call, but by no means have anywhere near achieved or realized, democracy. The social sense. Isms based upon the word social are man's usual rubbish, like any other isms, because they're all based upon the separate self. So those who talk of socialism are not really socialistic. The truly social person, the true socialist, is the one who is free from self-centered, isolated self-consciousness. When he has done that, then listen to him, and he may be able to speak something of value in connection with socialism. But until then, it is nonsensical. And the same applies to any other ism, whether totalitarian or not. Now, the difficulty then of living in the world, not as a worldling, that means therefore not being of the world, though we are in the world, but living in such a manner that there takes place the release of our full humanity. And remember, again and again, one can repeat it, the meaning of the word human, the happy creator. That is its full meaning. Who is the happy creator? We have always ascribed that to the creator, God or Brahman or whatever it is. But it is you and me that we are really concerned with. You have to be the happy creator. I have to be the happy creator. And you will see, therefore, that the meaning of the word creator in this fully human context is different from the ordinary meaning of that word creator in our everyday life, including even great art. You and I have to be the happy creator. And the happy creator comes into being when? And this is where the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad has a paragraph which is of inestimable value and which seems to have quite escaped the whole host of scholars and theologians through the centuries. The meaning of that word, human. He in whom all evil-mindedness is burnt out. The meaning of the word Purusha comes in the first chapter of the Brihadaranyaka, the fourth section, the very first two verses, particularly the first verse, explains that just very suggestively. Don't ask a philologist to accept what the Upanishad says. The philologist will quite legitimately say, oh, but this is all wrong philology. Never mind. Those people knew a transcendent philology. When they said that Purusha comes from Pur, meaning formally, and Ush, the root Ush means to burn up, and then they go on to say, well, what is burnt up? Sarvam papmanam. Sarvam, all, Papa is ill or evil, and unfortunately all the scholars translate it as has burnt out all evils. But there is the word papmanam. They leave out the manam part, which means the mind. Has burnt out all evil-mindedness, which is the root source of all the evil that I do, obviously. See? All right. So this is the great thing which we have to realize. Now when this is done, evil-mindedness is completely out. The attentiveness is utterly free of all self-consciousness. Then the state of communion is realized. Now what is the significance, the meaning of this state of communion? If you are in the state of communion, and remember that all the truly perfected holy ones of the past were lived in constant communion. The Buddha says openly, for instance, to Aggivesana, in the state of Shunyata Phala Samadhi, the samadhi, the communion, which is the fruit of the emptiness, in which I constantly abide, he says. That is the open statement. Jesus says, I and my Father are one. If my Father did not tell me this, that and the other, I would not tell you all this. What does that mean? The state of communion, then, is one in which, because of the complete freedom from separative self-consciousness, the complete freedom from all conditioning, from all limitations which make our minds opaque and obstructions to transcendent light, in that state all the senses function. The discursive mind itself functions, the speech faculty and the conceptual faculty function, not as my senses, as my conceiving, as my speech, but as that of transcendence itself. Therefore, when the perfected Holy One looks at you, it is transcendence, not transcendence in the sense of something other, but in the sense of the one total reality. The one total reality is looking through his eyes at you. The infinite is looking at the finite. And if it is looking through an organism, a psychophysical organism, which is so utterly purified, what he sees will be something transcendentally beyond what I, an ordinary worldling, see when I see you. Through the eyes of the Holy One, the total reality sees you as the individual person, knows you inside out completely, and simultaneously he sees the totality embodied in you. Not your totality, the total universe. This is the extraordinary thing. This is one of the profound meanings of what we call the omniscience of God. Now, try and feel this out with me as we go on, intensely and peacefully. when you see an object, transcendence looks through your eyes and sees the object as object, and also all materiality, the total materiality embodied in that object. What sort of a seeing is that? In that sort of seeing, there is no naming process. There is no separatively cognizing process. You see? This is something you and I don't know, do we? There is no separatively cognizing process. That is why I have said again and again that the Holy One knows by being that which he sees or hears or touches or thinks or feels. He is it completely in mind and consciousness. And if he is it completely in mind and consciousness, then the whole activity of separation is out, and he sees the perfect uniqueness of the particular in complete relationship with the totality and as the embodiment of that totality. This is the marvel and mystery of the functioning of the senses, your senses and my senses, when this state of communion is realized. And when you hear the singing of a bird or the explosion of an atom bomb, when you hear it, you will be hearing the thing in itself as a particular, and you will also be hearing the totality. Transcendence thus comes to fulfillment as man through you and through me. You know how, for instance, in Christian theology particularly, this is emphasized more than in the other great religions of the world. They say that not only is it a case of man seeking God, but God seeks man. God so loved the world that he gave his alone begotten Son. There is tremendous significance in statements like that. They are utterly meaningless to the multitudes. God seeks man with an intensity as compared with ours, which is in the proportion of the total cosmos, to me a tiny little speck of man dust on the globe. It's that sort of relationship, that sort of proportion. In other religions it is said that if man takes one step to God, God takes seven steps towards you. That is beautiful English understatement, but it doesn't come from England, that statement. So, think. I said think, but it's a bad word. Try and become intensely aware of it, with the utmost refinement and perfection and beauty you are capable of, with the utmost sensitivity you are capable of the significance, the meaning, the implications, the fact of communion and what it means. Now, Can one feel it? Don't try to make pictures of it. The imagination will run away with you. If you have the gift of a poet, of an artist, your genius will overflow into limited forms only. No limited form can contain the transcendent totality. It can't even truly express it. But the limited form, if the sheer genius is there, and you don't need to be a genius in the sense of a Beethoven or a Shakespeare or anything like that. If you are such a devotee that the whole of your being goes in love and adoration, then you will vibrate in tune with the transcendent reality. And in vibrating in tune with that transcendent reality, you will realize for yourself the meaning of the manhood being taken up into the Godhead. Now, if I am the Holy One myself, if I am in the state of communion, I am always still and silent. Because when I am silent, transcendence speaks the wordless language. I am blind, and when I am blind, transcendence sees truth, reality, through these very eyes. When I am empty, empty, that is to say, of all ill, void of all greed, hate, delusion, and such things. When I am empty like that, then transcendence is utterly unobstructed as it functions through this living organism. It is God incarnate which is sitting there, which is sitting here. This, which may be a faith to start with, is the reality when transcendent ethic, the purification of the heart, and the purification of the mind, transcendent intelligence, have come to fulfillment and are in harmony. And then the power of transcendence functions through you and utterly transmutes your total being, your actual psychophysical being, and your environment. Don't ask me how. In fact, never ask that question. Never ask to see with mortal eyes how that happens. Because eternity has no truck with time. Eternity is immortality, which is not continuance of entity through space and time. It's the realization of these things in your own inner being, which is the meaning of immortality. And this manifested being will inevitably die, body and soul alike, completely and utterly. That is God in liberation. God seeks liberation through you and through me. First, by coming to self-knowledge, not self-knowledge in the sense of John Brown or Firoz Mehta having self-knowledge, but God has his own self-knowledge through me, because I am empty and pure. I am the grail of transcendence itself. do try and... Well, don't try. Just let it happen. Just let this happen to you. And when we, as the poet says, shuffle off this mortal coil, this world will be a sweeter and a better place. It is not for me to see and to know, because that means that some degree of personal satisfaction is involved in it. In what way some good has been done. I may be clever enough, intellectually clever enough, to put it in that impersonal form. The fact is that I want to see what good I have done. You see, the self, selfness in the self, egoism in the ego, is a terrible devil. But he's a nice devil, because he is the one who becomes transformed into God. If he doesn't, well, then he has to join company with Lucifer. Not a very pleasant business. Now, where are our problems? What happens to our problems? We looked into this last time also. If you and I can maintain this awareness, this unself-conscious, unself-centered awareness, awareness not in the sense of cognizing particulars, but in the sense of being totally sensitive to the reality, whatever it may be. If you and I can maintain this, then that very awareness acts upon one's own being and upon the environment like sunshine. You know how sunlight heals, gives energy. The sun is the source of all energy and so forth. You shall be a sun unto yourself and to the world around you. This is one of the supreme meanings of the word yoga. Because it is not, if we say that yoga means the restoration or the rejoining of the self, oneself, to the supreme self, we have presented only a part of the whole thing. And the supreme self functions through you because you are unresisting, unobstructing, and utterly pure. Then there is no you, no separate you. And in that state, it is the power of transcendence itself which functions freely. And if we humans like to give it names in our poor language, we say this is absolute love, absolute wisdom, truth, beauty. Beauty such as this earth doesn't know, despite her own wondrous beauty. It is a beauty that never begins, never dies. It is the beauty which is eternally there. It is of the stuff of eternity. And with it is bliss, which has no relationship to our foolish pleasure or happiness or delight or any such thing. Once you touch this, no, let me put it the other way, I put it the wrong way. Once this touches you, that is the end of all self-seeking. It's not that you neglect yourself. Never forget the Buddha's great teaching, which as far as I'm aware, did not come from the lips of any of the other great holy ones. he who lives without hurting himself, without hurting others, lives with a self become Brahman. And note very carefully, he used the supreme word of the Hindus, the Upanishads, with a self which is Brahma become, Brahma Bhuta. Very, very significant. Because after all, self-hate, or the depreciation of whatsoever constitutes one's own psychophysical being, is an act of separation. It's an act of hate against not only oneself, but against the totality, because of which the individual self exists. If I wrong myself, I've also hurt totality. I've insulted totality in hurting myself. If I pamper myself, I am insulting totality in reverse. So now, I think I've attempted to put into words today what has never been attempted before, as far as I'm concerned anyway. But you can't attempt to put this in words unless something happens within which enables the least obstructive sort of conceptual process and verbal process to come into being. Otherwise, all conceiving and all verbalizing is self-oriented. This is the state, the condition of communion. It is the state of utter harmlessness. One is not a blot upon the face of the earth. One has become the instrument, the vehicle, the living vehicle through which transcendence manifests itself.